We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode and catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining me again today. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about today, including what might church look like in the coming months in this new COVID world? What is antibody testing? And we'll take a closer look at that new trial of the drug remdesivir as a possible treatment for coronavirus. But first, let's get started the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us.
Always happy to.
A new report predicts coronavirus could still be spreading throughout the United States for another 18 months to 2 years, either until we build up herd immunity or a vaccine is found. Do you agree with that?
It's certainly a possibility. I think any prediction here is dealing with a lot of unknowns. But I think given this idea, this range of possibilities is really important as we discuss all the different policy and health factors related to this. So, you know, we were just talking this morning amongst our leadership group of, it certainly looks like in the St. Louis region we flattened the curve. And really for the last, say 3, maybe even 4 weeks, at least in my hospital, we've had roughly the same exact number of COVID cases, which is about 10 to 15% of our census, maybe a little bit higher. But at any rate, the numbers are staying the same. The question here is just how long are they going to be like this? And I think preparing for the fact that this may be going on for a long time of just, you know, it looks like we flattened the curve. The trade-off with that is basically that there's going to be a steady stream of patients that are infected with this for a while. And it very well could be till a year or two, and maybe this is just our new reality. I think preparing for that, you know, we initially prepared for a surge. It doesn't look like we've had the surge yet or may not have that, but then preparing for that second reality. And the truth is nobody really knows. These are all just models and predictions and guesses, and there's a lot of assumptions with this, but I think it's certainly possible, and I think we certainly have to be prepared for.
What is herd immunity again?
So herd immunity is just the phenomenon of when a certain percentage of a population is immune or has been exposed to the disease and has no longer had it, that you kind of lose that critical mass of people that get infected that, you know, affects the population and creates basically a pandemic, which is what we're dealing with now. So, you know, as we've seen with this, what you really, you know, how COVID spreads is by close contact with having a certain percentage of people infected. And, you know, again, what's kind of interesting, terrifying about this is this idea of the super spreader. You know, there's one person that, you know, typically doesn't have symptoms or maybe does have symptoms that, you know, innocently infects a whole bunch of people, and that just kind of exponentially spreads. With herd immunity, if you have a number of people that, you know, in that crowded room where that one sick person is, if a certain percentage of them are already immune or vaccinated or have already had it, the spread is contained, and that's really the concept. You know, it's the same thing with immunizations. You don't have to get vaccines for everybody, but you have to get a certain percentage in order to prevent the spread of the disease. And, you know, polio is an example of this. You don't have to vaccinate everybody with polio. But with polio, and I don't know the exact number, but it's in the 90s. I think if 90% of the population is vaccinated, the odds are that you're not going to be able to spread that disease. There's just not enough people that are sick with the virus actively spreading the virus to really kind of make a large-scale infection of the population.
Earlier this week, Dr. Anthony Fauci said a vaccine is possible by January.
We're in the early phases of a trial, phase one. When you go into the next phase, we're going to safely and carefully, but as quickly as we possibly can, try and get an answer as to whether it works and is safe. And if so, we're going to start ramping up production with the companies involved. And you do that at risk. In other words, you don't wait until you get an answer before you start manufacturing. You at risk, proactively, start making it, assuming it's going to work.
Dr. Buchholz, is January realistic?
Well, like I said multiple times, Dr. Fauci is infinitely smarter than I am. So if he says so, sure. I think what he's talking about there is you're kind of doing multiple components at once. Is, you know, you're testing the vaccine to see it's effective, and at the same time ramping up your production of it so that if you have demonstrated effectiveness, you have a supply ready to be distributed. You know, usually these come as, you know, if you're a business making vaccine, you don't want to kind of put all this money into manufacturing for a vaccine that may or may not work, and then, you know, it doesn't work, and then you have this whole pile of vaccine that is essentially worthless. I mean, that's a very expensive thing. So I'm assuming you're saying there's some kind of program in place to at least guarantee the cost of that. And again, that gets rid of the steps. You're doing multiple steps at once, which makes a lot of sense. The trick with this is just making sure a vaccine is safe and effective. And again, there's a lot of other unknowns and variables as a part of this. So, I mean, if you give somebody a vaccine, you know, we've talked before about, you know, antibody tests and not being sure exactly what the antibody tests mean. We assume it confers immunity, but it may, we don't know for certain yet. So there's a whole bunch of assumptions that are going into this. And I think you have to make these assumptions because this is moving so fast and we've got to get something going. But the flip side of this is there might be downstream effects that we don't recognize yet. You know, the vaccine, for instance, I mean, you're doing this to prevent people from dying. But what if for some reason the vaccine causes death and those deaths are as much as COVID causes? Well, the cost benefit of that vaccine is worthless because, yes, it prevents COVID deaths, but if it kills you a different way, if you're dead, you're dead. It doesn't matter how you die. It matters that you're dead, which is what we want to avoid. So, you know, I tend to be cautious with this stuff. And again, that's in contrast to the fact that, you know, we have this terrible disease kind of ravaging our country and the world right now. But, you know, sometimes that delay and kind of rolling out things and that what seems like bureaucratic nonsense is really just making sure we're doing something that's safe. Remember, our first principle as physicians is first, do no harm. And, you know, I just kind of always go to that when we get real excited about the next treatment or the next thing that's coming out. We've got to make sure that this is the appropriate decision to make. So it's coming. I'm confident we're going to get something. I think January is a optimistic look, but it's certainly possible. Let's go for it. And then if it doesn't happen, let's not get too disappointed and just know that the science is really, really, really hard.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, more than half of American states have moved to reopen business in some way. That has Dr. Fauci worried.
The guidelines are very, very explicit and very clear. There's a lot of leeway because we give the governors the opportunity to be very flexible, but you have to have the core principles of the guidelines. You can't just leap over things and get into a situation where you're really tempting a rebound.
Dr. Buchholz, do you share his worry?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think, again, we don't have the mechanism in place, or the mechanisms in place, I should say, to, you know, kind of find hotspots of COVID and tamp down very, very quickly. And again, I've said before, you know, this lockdown is expensive. You know, people are suffering. We've had supply chain problems, not just with like healthcare equipment, but, you know, things as simple as food and our meat supply. The economy is certainly suffering. At the same token, you know, having somebody in the ICU or, you know, look at New York and having that happen across the country is insanely expensive as well, too. This isn't the lockdown that's causing all this expense and this loss of income. This is COVID. And so, you know, we've put things in place to kind of taper this down. And you just have to look at St. Louis. St. Louis had the potential. You know, I think, you know, if you looked at the initial numbers, it was getting scary. And certainly Missouri, St. Louis and the region is the hotspot of Missouri. But we've essentially tampered that. And that's great. now the steps are really in place. We got to put the steps in place to be able to test rapidly, to be able to test quickly at a large scale, and identify where things are occurring so we can intervene and be efficient on this. And we're nowhere near that yet. And I think that's the biggest concern. That's been the biggest failure of the system in general, of just not getting this ramped up in time has been a massive, massive problem. But, you know, again, if we have this area of overwhelm in New York, I mean, you're still hearing news reports about bodies piled up in trucks decomposing. I mean, the horror and, you know, the sheer volume of what happened there, I don't think people are comprehending yet. And if that happens in other countries or, I'm sorry, other counties or cities across the country, that's tragic because it's so preventable. And it's, you know, aside from the human toll of this, it's insanely expensive. And we're going to pay this cost one way or the other. Let's do it without having a bunch of people die as a result of that.
So we're nearly 7 weeks now into the shutdown. Why are so many people still getting sick?
Well, it's a great question. I think still, you know, there's still a lot of interaction. And I think there's still a lot of people that don't take this seriously or don't recognize the impact of this. And again, what I've seen just here with our own healthcare force is, you know, my theory, and again, this is more theory than fact, but I think it spread amongst ourselves asymptomatically, not by getting it from patients, but somebody's had it and is working with others, and we're using the right precautions. But once one mistake or one slip up or one inadvertent thing, and all of a sudden, you know, that one person infects 10 or 15. And that still kind of shocks me when I see that of, you know, one person gets sick on a shift and then all of a sudden everybody's got to get tested. You know, just think about a ward in the hospital or in the ICU. You know, once one person's been exposed and it's confirmed infection, you know, you're talking about 20 people that probably were working intimately with that person and that could be potentially infected. It just goes so quick. It's fascinating and terrifying at the same time. But I think that's what's going on is, you know, it just takes one person not to recognize this and then boom, you know, 10, 20, 30 people are potentially exposed and sick with this.
What do we know about the long-term effects of coronavirus once somebody recovers? What impact does it have on them later in life?
Well, nobody knows yet. We do know from the previous coronaviruses, so MERS and SARS, that you know, particularly people that are in the ICU and sick, a portion of them developed long-term lung disease, scarring of the lungs, basically. We've seen reports from people with COVID that have gotten or have received have gotten heart failure as a result of this. And then, you know, all these thrombotic risks that we've been talking about and the consequences of that, people having strokes. There's a Broadway actor, I guess, that lost his leg and is very sick right now. I mean, that's a fairly significant long-term consequence. I mean, once you lose your leg, you've lost your leg. Once you've had a stroke, you've had a stroke. You know, so, I mean, there's some potentially devastating consequences of this. I think we'll learn more of this over time. But I think definitely I think lung conditions after this are a distinct possibility. And I think it's partly a function of complications you had during this disease, the long-term consequences of that.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us. Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up, we'll find out more about that antiviral drug remdesivir. It's showing positive results in some coronavirus patients. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Let's talk about some good news in the battle to fight COVID-19. A possible treatment has been successfully tested in coronavirus patients worldwide, including more than a dozen here at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. SLU Care's Dr. Sarah George is the principal investigator of the local trial. Dr. George, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's hear what Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, had to say about remdesivir on Wednesday afternoon at the White House alongside President Trump.
The data shows that remdesivir has a clear-cut, significant, positive effect in diminishing the time to recovery. This is really quite important for a number of reasons, and I'll give you the data. It's highly significant. If you look at the time to recovery being shorter in the remdesivir arm, it was 11 days compared to 15 days. And that's a p-value, for the scientists who are listening, of 0.001. So that's something that, although a 31% improvement doesn't seem like a knockout 100%, it is a very important proof of concept. Because what it has proven is that a drug can block this virus. The mortality rate trended towards being better in the sense of less deaths in the remdesivir group, 8% versus 11% in the placebo group. The reason why we're making the announcement now is something that I believe people don't fully appreciate. Whenever you have clear-cut evidence that a drug works, you have an ethical obligation to immediately let the people who are in the placebo group know so that they could have access. And all of the other trials that are taking place now have a new standard of care. This drug happens to be blocking a enzyme that the virus uses.
Dr. George, what can you tell us about your study on remdesivir at St. Louis University School of Medicine as part of that larger federal trial? What are you looking at, and how big is your study?
Well, our study is part of, as you were saying, a big federal NIH study that's actually running across 75 sites in the United States and around the world, and has enrolled something like 1,000-odd patients as of this time across all those sites. And our study is essentially evaluating whether remdesivir is beneficial in people hospitalized with COVID-19 disease. To really study that correctly, you do have to use a placebo because, of course, a lot of people with COVID-19, not everybody, do get better on their own. So you really have to evaluate any new drug against a placebo, which means, you know, a saline or something, to see whether or not it's effective.
And what have you found so far?
Well, first of all, we're very, very glad we could be in this study and could offer this drug to our patients as part of this trial. As Dr. Fauci just discussed, remdesivir, based on the whole data put together in this study, was beneficial in people hospitalized with COVID-19 disease. It reduced, did not eliminate, both the death rate and reduced the time to recovery.
What did the numbers in your study show?
The numbers based on the percentages from what I have heard is that the death rate in the remdesivir group, and remember, these were people sick enough to be hospitalized and some of them were in intensive care and so on. The death rate in the remdesivir group was 8%, whereas the death rate in the placebo group was 11%. So that's a 3% difference. But more importantly, the time to recovery was statistically significantly different, where it was 11 days if people got remdesivir and 15 days if they did not.
So this is a treatment and not a cure?
Correct. This is a treatment and not a cure, but this is the first drug that has shown any real beneficial effect, and it's the first drug that we can reasonably say, yes, it's an effective treatment.
And Dr. Fauci says this will now be the new standard of care for COVID-19 patients. What does that mean?
That means that people who are sick enough to be hospitalized with COVID-19 disease, which is, remember, a minority of cases, most cases are well enough to stay home and quarantine, but people who are sick enough to be hospitalized with it should get this medication, assuming we have enough supplies, which is a whole other issue.
What can be done about that?
Well, the company that makes the drug, Gilead Pharmaceuticals, is certainly scaling up production as fast as they can, and Gilead will have to address the supply issue. Remember, this is being injected into people, so of course it has to be made completely safe and all proper safety taken into account. So it's going to be scaled up as much as it can, as fast as it can.
What's left to do in your study, Dr. George?
Well, as has been pointed out, as you were saying earlier, this is not a cure. So now we need to ask, okay, remdesivir is good. If we added something to remdesivir, would it be better? That's the question you ask at this point. If you give remdesivir with something else, do you get even better numbers?
And is that something you're ready to start investigating right now?
We're ready to do it, and we should be starting to do that again in the next few days, I hope.
Dr. George, how good are you feeling right now?
Honestly, this is the first good news we've had about COVID-19 since this whole outbreak started. And this is the first drug that has actually shown any real beneficial effect, despite some other drugs that have been hyped in the media, which had actually no beneficial effect, and some of them were even harmful.
How does remdesivir work, Dr. George?
Remdesivir is an antiviral that interferes with the virus's ability to replicate. If the virus cannot reproduce itself, it cannot do you any harm or injury. The virus, the way it does its damage is it gets inside your body's cells, takes them over, and turns them into virus factories. And if you stop remdesivir's ability to do that, then the virus can't do anything to you, and you can't transmit it to other people.
How has remdesivir been used in the past?
Remdesivir is not licensed yet by FDA. It is still considered at this time an experimental drug, but it has been tested in Ebola vaccine, in Ebola treatment trials, and with some other viruses as well.
How are you getting patients to study at St. Louis University School of Medicine?
Well, we are offering the study to people who are hospitalized with COVID-19 disease. And then, of course, they have to decide whether or not to participate. It's a research study, so people always, you know, have the option that they just don't want to participate. That's perfectly fine. They have to freely consent.
How many have been tested so far?
Right now at our institution, I think we enrolled about 14 people. But remember, for the larger study across 75-odd sites in the U.S. and around the world, it was over 1,000.
Dr. George, thanks a lot. Really appreciate talking to you.
My pleasure.
Dr. Sarah George is a SLU Care infectious diseases specialist and principal investigator of this trial that's underway at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up, what do you know about antibody testing? We're hearing a lot about it these days. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
From everything we hear, it appears that antibody testing will be one of the major pillars in getting America back on track. Here to talk with us about antibody testing is Dr. Neil Anderson. Dr. Anderson is an assistant professor of pathology and immunology at Washington University School of Medicine. He's also the assistant medical director of the Barnes Jewish Clinical Microbiology Laboratory. Dr. Anderson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what is antibody testing?
Sure. So antibody testing is actually measuring the body's response to a pathogen. It's an indirect way of looking for the pathogen. So the majority of the COVID-19 testing so far has been molecular testing, in which case we're looking for the molecular signature of the virus. However, with antibody testing, what we're actually measuring is not the virus at all, but antibodies that you made to the virus, which is a presumable marker that you've been exposed to the virus.
Is this in the testing stage, or is this already on the market if you want to get your antibodies tested?
So it's a little bit of both, actually. So there are serologic or antibody tests available. Serology and antibodies can be used interchangeably. Those tests are currently available. The FDA has taken a different stance for these tests as they have with other tests. So they are actually not requiring FDA review. That's been kind of a double-edged sword. It means that now there are actually hundreds of antibody tests that are currently out there and available. The challenge with that is because there hasn't been this vetting by the FDA, the performance of these tests is quite variable. There's some really good tests out there, and there's some really bad tests out there.
How can you tell the difference?
So that's a great question. Typically, that is the job of the laboratory that is going to be offering the tests, or the FDA. What we have to do are these extensive processes that we refer to as validation and verification, where we take a test, we run it using specimens from patients that we know have the disease, and specimens from patients that we know do not have the disease. And some of those patients that we know do not have the disease, we try to find specimens from patients that might have things that cross-react, so that we're very thoroughly evaluating these assays and kind of trying to figure out where their Achilles heels are, because those can have really meaningful consequences when we actually put them out there in the public for routine testing.
So let's assume we've got a good antibody test. Do we know what antibody levels people need to have immunity?
The short answer to that is no. We're still very early on in the use of these tests. And at this time, it is not entirely clear what level of antibodies you need to have. Kind of a challenging part of this as well is a lot of the tests out there don't really even give you a level. They just say you're positive or negative. So positive, it might mean that you've been exposed to the virus, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you are immune to reinfection.
And if we don't really know what levels are needed to have immunity, do we have any idea yet how long people will have immunity if they have those antibody levels?
That is something that we need more data on as well. At this time, we do not know the length of immunity in patients that are serologically positive. What we need to see is how patients that are serologically positive now evolve over time. We need to see if they are reinfected as this pandemic goes on. Unfortunately, we're in the early days right now, so it's hard to judge how long immunity lasts.
We're talking with Dr. Neil Anderson. Dr. Anderson is an assistant professor of pathology and immunology at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Anderson, are you doing any studying of antibodies there?
So we currently are evaluating different assays that are commercially available, and we are potentially looking at implementing some antibody testing locally. However, at this time, we're in the evaluation phase.
So how big do you think antibody testing will become over the next few weeks or months?
You know, that's a very interesting question. We've heard just this past week, we've heard quite a bit about antibody testing in the lay press. And I suspect we're going to hear more. I do think that there's a lot of additional conversation that needs to be had, both between public health officials, the scientific community, to figure out exactly what the utility are of these antibody tests. However, I think it's pretty apparent that there's going to at least be some amount of high-level testing throughout the country.
Dr. Anderson, in the perfect world, how will antibody testing be used?
Well, in, that's a great question. It really depends on the pathogen and what we know about the pathogen. In the perfect world, what I would like to see is I would like to see more data on what exactly it means to be antibody positive. Once we figure out what exactly it means to be antibody positive, then we know how to use these better. It could be that antibody positive means immunity, in which case they would be safe to use that way. However, it could be that antibody positive doesn't mean you're immune. It might just be a marker that you've been exposed. So it really, in a perfect world, I'd like to see more data and then evidence-based approaches to how these are going to be used.
I know I've heard from a couple of people who say, I can't wait to get an antibody test done on me so I can see whether I've had it or not, and then I can relax. Will that ever be the case?
Well, I think what a lot of people need to keep in mind is that because there's so many tests out there and they have such variable performance, you could be negative and have been exposed, or you could be positive and you were never exposed. So I think people looking to these tests as a way of providing peace of mind, it actually could cause the opposite. It could give you a mistaken impression that you either were or were not exposed. So, to those people who are waiting for an antibody test and very excited about it, I just want to make sure that we have appropriately tempered expectations about the performance of these tests.
And how long do you think it'll be before we get some answers that are solid on this?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it's going to take quite some time. I would say in the next few months, we will be seeing a lot more data about the antibody tests. They have just become available, so it takes time to actually have these tests being routinely used. before we're able to figure out, yeah, this positive means this or a positive doesn't mean that. So potentially, you know, we're looking at weeks to months here.
Dr. Anderson, where can people go to learn more about antibody testing?
That's a fantastic question. What I'd recommend is, you know, we're seeing a lot about antibody testing in the lay press. I would recommend that people supplement what they hear from, you know, news and whatnot with some of the scientific evidence that's out there. So the Infectious Disease Society of America has recently put out guidelines about antibody testing and how those should be interpreted. Those are easily found on the internet. I'd recommend people look into those. I'd recommend people, you know, depending on what location you're in, check with your state and public health references that you can potentially find online. There's a lot of good resources for data about antibody testing that I think people will find helpful.
Dr. Anderson, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Neil Anderson is an assistant professor of pathology and immunology at Washington University School of Medicine. He's also assistant medical director of the Barnes Jewish Clinical Microbiology Laboratory. Coming up, what do you think churches, synagogues, and mosques might look like once we're allowed to go back? You're listening to Health Matters. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Have you wondered what houses of worship might look like in this new COVID-19 world? Let's ask Father Tom Reese. Father Reese is a senior analyst at the Religion News Service. Father Reese, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Father Reese, tell me how you think social distancing may change the way we do church in the future.
Well, I think if we don't get a vaccine pretty soon, and most experts don't think we're going to get one until a year or maybe 2 years or even more, we're going to have to practice social distancing if we're going to have church at all. You know, the normal church experience is a recipe for a plague. I mean, you come into church, first of all, you crowd at the door getting in, and then when you come in, you're in a crowded room with people all around you of all ages, old, young, sick, not sick, people with immune issues, things that would make catching the virus deadly. And then if it's a normal kind of Catholic church or church that has a Eucharist, you're going to be breaking bread together. You're going to be sharing bread. And now in the Catholic, some Catholics like to receive on the tongue, which is very dangerous in this kind of infectious environment. Plus, you know, the priest isn't wearing gloves. So, you know, he may be, or one of the other ministers may be asymptomatic, and so could be spreading the disease to the entire community. There's just all, and this is saying nothing about the exchange of kiss or hugging or shaking hands, all of the things we're not supposed to be doing. So it makes the church experience really very dangerous. Now the question is there some way we could change it, modify the church experience so it's not so dangerous, it's not so risky? Well, I just imagine what it would be for a pastor. First, he'd have to go into the church and mark the pews so that each person is 6 feet away from any other person. Well, that's going to cut down the number of people you're going to be able to have in your church. You know, maybe you have 500 people coming to church every Sunday, and you look at your church and, well, we can only have about 50 in this church if we keep 6 feet apart. Well, that means you're going to have 10 services. You can't just have one service. So it's things like this that we have to start thinking about. And how do you get people to observe these kinds of rules, these kinds of distancing? You know, even outside, you'd have to put lines outside the door to make people kept 6 feet apart as they approach the church or as they left the church. I mean, we Catholics, you know, when Catholics who went to parochial grammar schools knew how the the nuns would march us in and march us out, and we did did absolutely everything they told us to. We saluted and no questions asked. Well, we need to have that kind of regiment to pull off this kind of social distancing without putting people at risk. I'm not sure we can do that. I'm not sure we're able to do that, but that's what it would require.
Do you think tickets would be needed? How would people know which service to attend and where to sit?
This is a logistic nightmare. I mean, you'd have to get, you'd have to have some system of determining which service each person is supposed to go to and make, okay, that's the service you go to and not, you know, not, oh, well, I slept in. I'm going to go to one of the later ones. Well, there's no room for you at the later one. So, we'd have to have some kind of a system for, we'd need a logistic manager, a general, to organize this and to make sure that everybody knew which service they were supposed to go to.
And could communion even be done?
Well, that's really problematic. Certainly, communion on the tongue is impossible. I've given communion on the tongue to lots of people. Well, inevitably you hit somebody's tongue. The last time I did communion service, I warned everybody. I said, because of the virus, really we should do it in the hand. But if you do come up and, want it on the tongue, I'll do it. But if I touch your tongue, I'm going to have to stop, go over and sterilize my fingers before I can continue giving communion. Well, the result was everybody came up and took communion in the hand. But even communion in the hand is a problem. Suppose I'm infected and don't know it. Suppose I'm off some, have it but have no symptoms. Or, even communion in the hand. That last time I had a communion service, I noticed how many times I touched people's hands when I was giving out the communion in their hands. That's just not a safe way of doing it. I think what we'd have to do is, I said that in the church you'd have to mark places where people would sit and be 6 feet apart. Well, I think every one of those spots, you would have to leave an unconsecrated host. And then during the Mass, the priest would consecrate all those hosts that are out there in the congregation, and then people at communion could receive the communion. That I think that would also have the advantage is there'd be no communion line. I mean, communion lines tend to get clogged up and people close to one another. So all of these things, we would have to do, and getting people so that's a habit. You can't be sloppy. You can't be inattentive on these kinds of things because you put people's lives at risk. So I'm not sure we're capable of doing it, but it certainly would be a very different church. It would be, one where, you have to have an usher or somebody saying, no, stay your distance. This is where you go. This is where you're going to sit. No, you don't have choices. You got to be with the program. I think a lot of people would have problems with that, but I think that's the only way we could keep people safe.
Father Reese, thanks so much for your time. Always good talking to you.
Okay, good to be with you again, Fred.
Father Tom Reese is a senior analyst at the Religion News Service. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.